You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Neil Williams, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Neil Williams. Neil.
Good afternoon.
Seems like it's been a minute or so since I've been around anyway, so it's glad to be back on the program and talk about our topic we have going. I guess, without, you know, further ado on that, been getting a lot of rain out here.
Yeah, it's still pouring over where I am, too. Well, they just slowed down.
And I'm hoping, like most Texas, whatever, that this will be all the rain we get until, like, November, which I fear. I really fear that. So, and it's going to be a super hot Al Gore global warming summer. We'll see. But
yeah, you're probably not wrong there.
Anyway.
Get some light.
Get some light in there.
Yeah, it's dark. Well, usually the daylight.
Usually the daylight's plenty, but yeah. I forgot that it's so overcast.
It is. Well, I'll start to broach our topic today. I think that in the recovery business, there are a lot of people involved in that business. Certainly, are the people that work at the recovery centers or the treatment centers. And we're going to talk about the treatment center today. We're not going to talk about sober living or aftercare stuff. Let's kind of focus our discussion on the first treatment stop. Okay. Because that's kind of where the issues are, I think, is in that first stop.
Not detox, but the actual inpatient,
right,
correct?
To clarify, right. Not the detox, but the actual treatment after the detox.
Not everybody has to make that first stop.
But many do. So the person finishes their detox and they're eligible to get in the treatment, and they start their treatment. And some of the treatment programs can be 30 days, 45 days, 6 days, etc. Is that when the person is involved in treatment, when is that person done? I mean, when is that person ready to go on to the next thing, whether that be home or sober living environment or whatever? And that's an interesting question, right? Because everybody's a little bit different. Everybody's recovery is just a little bit different than the other person. So it's not a cookie cutter thing. Now, for some treatment centers, is the person ready when the insurance runs out, when the money runs out, right? That's an issue, right? So that's kind of a forced play. Person doesn't have coverage, and that's a wrap. They might not even want to go, and they have to go, okay?
Right.
But there are other people, and I want to, if we can, develop the other segment where maybe it's a longer term program, you know,
like a 90 day,
90 days to 6 months program, and or beyond. It can be a longer program than 6 months. Okay, so there's some residential programs that go a long time.
Yeah,
I've seen a lot of that in my youth clients, but.
The 18-month programs.
Yeah. So there's a situation sometimes where the person kind of overstays their welcome in treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's kind of.
You can certainly overstay your welcome. If you're simply not going to comply, you can have that, which I worked with a family getting him into treatment, and week by week it was, Let's just give him a little time to settle in. Let's get him, you know, let him get acclimated. Let him get used to the folks, meet some people. Like 4 or 5 weeks in, like, okay, still not going well. It's like, dang, some people just are not going. They're not ready. They're not willing to do it. And those are tough because you've insurance has been used. Money's been spent. You got them sober. And especially for the family who are not addicts or alcoholics and trying to understand, like, you said that once he got sober, you said that once he snapped out of this, and they're probably saying you said to all the professionals who have been giving them direction, and in their defense, I get it, but there's another one of a million reasons why this disease is such a fickle, confusing, cunning, baffling thing, because sometimes they're just not ready for it. There's that.
I like that. I like the part about, especially when you're not complying with the rules. Now, sometimes there's some subjectivity with complying with the rules, right? The beauty's in the eye of the beholder sometimes. One staff member may be totally fine with this guy. Another staff member or the program director or assistant director may be not fine with this guy. Right? And so then there's some subjectivity in there on who's, you know, who is saying this person isn't complying with the rules.
Yeah.
So.
Now, and when you say that, are you alluding to maybe like different aspects of the treatment? Like, well, he's been great over here when it comes to the morning meditation meeting. You know, he's great here. And then when it comes to the ropes course or team building exercises, he's totally withdrawn. And you mean something like that?
Yeah. Example. Further. Yeah, they're somehow doing good in some things, not doing good in others. And then sometimes actually it's just a personality clash. I know it sounds so subjective, doesn't it? That you'd actually have personality clashes between a client and staff in a treatment center, but it happens.
All human beings, they're all human beings. Yes. Not only that, but in the treatment industry, there's a lot of folks who are in recovery themselves. That's why they're working in the treatment industry. And if you know any alcoholics like I know alcoholics, we've got some strong personalities behind the alcohol, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, you can have those polarizing figures that are going to clash with a lot of personalities.
By saying principles before personalities sometimes.
You might light a fire with that one. You're taking some ammunition from their arsenal and shooting it back at them.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And man, that can really, you know, fan the flames and make things worse, or it can cause, man, I mean, it puts me in check just saying it. Cause I'm saying that to myself. And I think to myself, how guilty I am of that myself in my daily affairs, you know, that I have to watch my, whatever biases, right, that I have towards certain things. You know, I even told you a story recently about somebody actually made a phone call to me and said some, you know, interesting and very kind things. And I said to you, like, that's it. That guy's in my inner circle, man. That's just, you know what I mean? The biggest sign of loyalty ever. And man, that's subjective.
Yeah.
You know, and it's going to,
right.
That guy's going to have to do everything but burn my house down for me to not think very fondly of him.
Yeah.
Okay. But you know what? We can do the reverse. Somebody can do something. I hate that son of a gun. That guy's a POS, this and that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe they don't deserve that. Maybe you're projecting or doing some dry drunk stuff or whatever, you know, like, you know, maybe it's,
well,
you.
In if, since we pulled the first thing out of the program, I'll pull another thing out of there. There's the, have you ever heard of the sick man's prayer?
Yeah.
Sick man's prayer is huge because every time someone is treated, I feel like I'm being attacked. I need to consider, is that person sick? You know?
Yeah.
And so the prayer is, God save me from being angry. This is a sick man. God save me from being angry at them. And you have to recognize their positioning. And the idea is for me to remember that I've been there too. And I too have been guilty of that. And it's really not me that they're, it might be me actually, you know, if I really did something, it might be, but a lot of that anger and frustration might be because of where they are in their life. They're not in a good place and they're projecting it on me. And that's something I have to remember also.
And Neil, let's just go there with your distance video and we'll circle the wagon. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's, isn't that what you were saying with the distance video? People are treating you in a certain way. Or they're distancing themselves from you.
Right.
And then you're thinking, wow. And then you finally came to believe that, hey, they were just doing the best they could do. But go ahead and you do it. It's your video.
Yeah. And one that took years. That's the weird thing about it is I had some resentments towards people for pushing me away or simply just creating space between me and them. And I thought they were just leaving me when I was in a time in my life where I felt like I needed more support. But again, I wasn't thinking too clearly because I wasn't doing anything to help myself. So they were doing the right thing by recognizing this guy's not going to do anything for himself. What good am I doing anybody by sticking around? And they're just he's just pulling me down.
Yeah.
So they create distance. And then when everything came full circle and I was doing that for myself, deciding who I needed to create distance from and, you know, kind of clean out my inner circle and make sure I had healthy people around me, I then realized, oh, hell, this is exactly what those people were doing with me. And I didn't make the cut, you know.
Yeah.
But good for them, for real, good for them, because these were people who – we were close, you know, so I don't think it was easy for them to do that, you know.
And I'll say this. I mean, when did I have you come over? Was that 2009 or 10? No, it was 2010. So I would say between 2009 and 10, I saw you as a very angry person. What are you laughing at?
I'm laughing because I was.
Man, I
just know people are thinking.
I'm all Jack glasses. I thought, yeah, but if I tell them I have them, and it's been, now it's been 11 years. Man, is he going to go off on me? Like, why didn't you give these back to me before? And not really. I didn't think that. But, okay, that's a little joke. But at the time, man, dude, like. All I'm trying to say is I can see why people back then would want to get distance from you.
Yeah.
And I'm a guy who gets in tumbles with whatever, you know what I mean? So I was a little bit better at hanging in the space, you know what I mean? Yeah. But if I was just a regular citizen seeing you back then, I might have done that. And I'm not trying to back up the people that got distance from you. But boy, from that period, I mean, I could definitely see it.
Well, in hindsight, you know, it's easy to see how reckless and short fused I was, you know, and, you know, when I see people like that, it's not necessarily that you're scared, but it's certainly easy to say, well, it's probably better if I just stay away from that dude. He don't look like he's in a great place.
Right.
I'm going to let him be.
Right.
You know?
Right. Or, yeah, well, I'm going to get him out of my treatment program.
Yeah.
I'm not saying mine, but I'm talking about if, yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
well, no, that's real though. And that happened when I was in treatment with, here, once again, I'm a classic example. I was in treatment and I had a bad attitude, and this kitchen or a resident, whatever you choose to call them in your program. I was a resident at this inpatient facility and I was sober. I'd been sober for a couple weeks, so I was sharp, right? My mind was back on it, but my attitude wasn't in a good place. So I was using my intelligence and my wittiness and all of that to my advantage. And I was really messing with people, especially the counselors, you know, these fresh newbies who are just trying to help and just trying to do something good. And here comes this asshole who is just looking for people to mess with. And that was me for a little while. And I did get pulled out. Then they talked to me. They were like, listen, if you're going to keep doing this, you're screwing up every single class. And everybody's like getting on board with you. You're creating a mutiny here. Like, it's not going to work. We're going to kick you out. And they really did. They told me I better get it together, that they were going to kick me out.
Yeah.
I don't blame them.
Yeah. And you can't, and as a former program administrator, you know, you can't have disruptive people in your program. You just can't, because they'll drag down the therapeutic community, or they'll drag down a segment of your population. And then you have to make these decisions based on the greater good of your treatment center or of your population that you have. Right. And so,
yeah.
And sadly, I've made those decisions, and I'd bring the guy out of group, and we're going to do one-to-ones. And my objective of the one-to-ones is I'm going to get you back in group. We're going to get through dealing with, so you can go back into group. And man, if we couldn't get to the point where we went back in group, the guy just wasn't ready. I said, look, when you're ready to come back to this type of program, then let me know and we'll get you back in there. And this isn't about being sober either. This is about attitude and behavior and anger,
yeah,
and defiance and not accepting responsibility, et cetera, and blaming and minimizing and rationalizing just by every thinking error that you can come up with before the person can even accept why they're there, you know, in jail or prison, rather. It'd be, oh, this dude, I was in a conspiracy and this snitch. And I would like, I would fire you. Like, you have to come to believe you're here in prison because of what you did. If you're sitting here on a 5-10 year sentence, I simply can't do that. You know, I tried when I was young. I would try to convince these guys, I'm going to do some cognitive work and I'm going to get them to see the light. Screw that. I don't have time for that. Once I got on my career, you know, like you have to believe that you're here. So anyway, long story short is that the person who's either not compliant or just mentally not ready, right?
Not mentally ready.
Was that kind of a, okay.
I don't know.
Okay. Wait.
I know what you're saying.
I take it back. They're not willing. They're not.
That's
honesty, open-mindedness, and willing. How's that?
That's always it.
All right, man.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And unfortunately, to be willing, you have to get your ass handed to you, man.
Sometimes.
Most of the time, you really got to get beat up. But so that's one scenario.
I know, that's an easy one.
Yeah. What's another?
Oh, man. No. Okay. Okay. Let's make one. Kind of a cushy treatment center. Private pay. Can go on anywhere from 3 months to a year plus, depending on the person's issues and their ability to pay. What else? I'm trying to think of the context first, right?
Maybe someone who's using it to keep them sober.
using what?
When they leave.
There you go. That's nice.
But they've got the money and you've got a place. So leave me alone, take my money and let me be here and just shut up. Because we got, you know, there's people, you know, some people like that. Oh, I know some people like that.
Oh, yeah.
That it's hotel sober for them. I need to go. I need to get some sobriety. Well, I've got endless amounts of cash. So these jack wagons in Pasadena will hold me. You know, it's.
Yeah, no.
And that's what some of them think. And in their defense, there's a lot of people in the industry that will just say, yeah, absolutely. You want to pay me? Come on.
Yeah.
This, because we're talking about money now.
Oh, I know.
Now we're talking about moral compass, ethical balance.
Right.
What are you about to say?
No, I'm not about to say anything. I'm taking everything you're saying in because, like you said, that can spider web off of different directions. I got an example.
Okay.
Or at least half of it is an example. So there's this young adult in a treatment program, and they had been there for a while, and they were ready to go to the transitional house or the phase, like a phase two house. And so there was a meeting held with the powers that be, and then the parents of this kid were like, well, I mean, is he ready or what? Like, no, he's not quite in phase one, you know. And after all, you got to invest in your kids, right? You know what I mean? Said this other person to these parents. So that's the opposite approach, trying to make the kids stay in the treatment maybe a little bit longer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was really based on empirical data or census cash flow. And then funny thing is that same kid had somehow overstayed his welcome 40 days later.
Yeah.
It was determined through some other subjectivity that the kid had to leave or the young adult male had to leave. So I'm like, man, after all that, you know, wooing the stakeholders and the parents for the money. I was here. Wow.
Sometimes that's that right there reveals the ulterior motives. You know, well, how come all of a sudden he's just not a fit? I thought you said they needed more.
Right.
But now you're saying they're not a fit.
And in 30, 40 days, all of a sudden things take a hard turn. And there's really not an explanation for the hard turn, you know.
Yeah.
Usually, you know, I'm expecting data points like he set a fire, he did this, or you know, he said this, or alienated staff, alienated other resident. But anyhow, so I just, it's kind of interesting how these things can happen, and the person now all of a sudden is over. Oh, they're welcome. And it's kind of like, now what? Now what do we do? Now where is this parent? Now what does this person do? Like, oh, they can't go to this program's phase two house, so they have to find another sober living environment. Or, you know, are we looking at Oxford House now? If the person can't go into somebody's home or transition right into society, and now because of sometimes those decisions, that person's put on blast, and or their family's put on blast to find the next place.
And I think this also highlights the importance of what kind of measurables you have for your census. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because I've been through, when I went through a state funded, you know, it was a state funded treatment, state run. So it was a corrections facility, and the measurables used there were completion of phases, but it was real simple how to complete your phase. It was, and granted, I understand this corrections facility, so it's different, But for the sake of example, it was complete this packet, memorize this written statement, repeat it back to me, give me your packet. You did this, this, this on a phase two. And when you're, if you're in treatment, and we're talking about private payer insurance, whatever, an actual treatment facility, you can't always do it like that. In fact, I don't think you ever should, because just doing some paperwork, and that's also why sponsorship is a lot more than some silly packets. Because if you think that an alcoholic or an addict cannot BS his way through a packet, his or her, the art of bullshit is like ingrained in alcoholics and addicts.
Right.
You know, the level of manipulation knows no bounds. So what are your measurables? You know, because just like you said in the beginning, and we say all the time, recovery is not universal. It's not cookie cutter. It's not one size fits all. So how are we gauging, you know, these people's progression?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And that's why it's always a combination of, you know, what they're doing in their groups, what they're doing with their individual work, what they're doing with their steps or their program and or their sponsor. And we would have a team approach. And I'd ask the therapist, well, how's he doing there? And I'd ask, how's he doing in your class? How's he doing at night? How is the person with their recreation? How are they doing with their family? And really take all the aspects of the person's life into that progress decision. I even did that in prison.
Yeah.
I'd monitor their mail. I'd monitor. We have special investigation technicians monitoring their phone calls, monitoring their mail. Nowadays they can monitor their email. Same thing. Just kind of look at what the guy's doing when nobody's looking, you know, like their integrity. Like what are they doing when nobody's looking, and see if there's a disparity there. You know, and so anyway, so that's, you know, that's just me, you know, liking to see that integrative approach. Actually, well, just kind of comes to mind, hired by some parents, he'd been in a youth facility in Maine, and I asked about the level work. I asked about his group participation. The guy was going to NA meetings, and then I literally had to call the program director and say, hey, man, I'll be doing this kid's aftercare, and I've been working with you guys for 15 years, you know, not with them, but you know what I'm saying, doing aftercare for their people for about 15 years, and actually transporting to them. When I was young, I could. Anyway, so I'm like, hey, man, what's going on? Well, you know, this guy, you know, this is, he just had all this subjective stuff. And so I'm like, you know, I'm like, you're really not telling me anything that I can really hang on to. So I'm going to tell you this. I'm trying to get my aftercare schedule running. I'm thinking you guys can get this guy ready in 6 weeks so I can plug him into my aftercare schedule. Yeah, you think that's a goal? Oh, yeah, I think we can get this guy. You know what I mean? So I kind of spy in the ointment, and it was subjective, kind of a personality, maybe a beef with one of the staff. You know what I mean? Not all the staff.
Yeah.
And that's what it was, truth be told, once I got him and, you know, ran the post-mortem analysis, it was a beef with one guy, staff member. And that's a shame, man. You're going to hang a guy's treatment progress up over a beef. I get it. I mean, I get it. It happens. It's not good, though. So, yeah.
Yeah, that can mess up a lot, too. That can mess up the way that person views treatment and recovery. And that can mess up the way people view your program.
Yeah.
Or all programs, for that matter. Some of these families only encounter one treatment facility. And if you do it the wrong way, you have just pissed in the well.
For the whole concept, right? For all treatment, right?
You know how many, I don't know the answer to this, actually. I have no idea how many guys that I sponsor who tell me horror stories about their first AA meetings or their first sponsor, you know, like the sponsor who says, this was crazy. You can't share in a meeting until you're 6 months sober. And you got to go to meetings for 6 months and not talk. Shut up. I don't tell people that.
Man,
you're not a dictator. So that happens with all sorts of stuff.
I'd heard that too. You know, maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks, but 6 months, like you can't. That's more of a dictatorship. And it's kind of, you know, I've heard that. You're familiar with prison in one sense, and I'm familiar with prison in another. Anyway, being the dictator, I would never do that. You know, it's kind of funny. Yeah.
Well, and really, you want them, the realistic approach when it comes to sponsorship and your new guys, I want them to understand how it works.
Yeah.
And I want them to know what to say, what the purpose of your sharing is. I want them to understand that, hey, it's not just to sit here and complain. And I also want them to understand that it's part of you being part of the group. And I also want them to know that you don't want to talk too long. So I encourage them right off the bat, hey, let's get you sharing. If you're uncomfortable, just say your name, why you're here, introduce yourself.
Yeah.
No big deal, but get them plugged in. So I gently nudge them into that. But people, you know, control is something that a lot of us struggle with in recovery. We want to control everything. Excuse me. And so that's, I think, why it's so common for sponsors to do that, because it's a classic personality trait. Or shortcoming, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and we got to be creative. I used to take a picture of every person and make them hold a card underneath their chin. It's in prison. Like, we would say, I am not my poverty. I'm not my race. All these, you know, I'm not, you know, I'm taking responsibility. I take a picture of them. And so if they started in group editing or, you know, other stuff, I'm like, wait. And I pull that picture out. You know, I had to do whatever I had to do by any means necessary to survive. You know, my mom was blah, 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 performing sex acts while I was in the hood in the pod. Whoa, stop. Stop with that. Get the picture out. I'm not my poverty. I'm not my, you know. So sometimes we have to have little instructive prompts for people not to go if they fly the victim stance or if they tell war stories or they glamorize or they editorialize or if they intellectualize. So it's really interesting kind of corralling people into sincere discussion. You know what I mean? They're talking about themselves and their experience and their feeling, but none of this societal, you know.
Yeah. When people have built up an identity based on things like that, and then they come in and that's all they have, I think I know for me, I felt really lost because my identity was based on, you know, things that were false, you know, things. So it was,
when you
pull that rug out from under someone and you're like, hey, everything you think you are is really nothing. And so now knowing that, who are you?
Right.
I didn't know.
Or who do you want to become? Right.
Yeah.
You're not your mistakes, but you are who you become. And that consists of choices you start making today. You know, who do you want to become? And it's not too late. It's not too late. Sex offender registry. I know it's pretty harsh, but anyway, but you know what I mean? It's you are who you become. And and just empowering people to snap out of some of those chains of the past that bound them and work on something together, like right here, right now with us or with the group or whatever, or you know, our relationship as a coach or sponsor, whatever, you know, who are you mm-hmm. right now? You know, and I know you're working with a young guy who's, you know, now able to see what might be ahead of him. He's in school now and has some hopes, right, toward a psychology degree and might end up in this industry one day. I don't think he really yeah. saw that maybe even 2 years ago, you know?
Well, there's no way. You can't see it. You can't. And then it happens really quickly. It takes a lot of work, but then all of a sudden your eyes open and the possibilities show up really fast.
And you can
it's part of the miracle, you know, part of the miracle. Cause all of a sudden, because that's what everybody says. They're like, I just, you know, 30 days ago, this or 60 days ago, there was no way this would be possible. It's like, that's the beauty of it. You're absolutely right. You can't see out of it when you're still in it. But once somebody helps you kind of clear the air and create that distance, if you will, from that lifestyle, then all of a sudden you're able to think, hear, and see a little bit more clearly.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Can't see out of those.
Yeah. It's not that the things weren't there. It's just that we invite a lot of fog. There you can't see.
Takes
yeah, it makes me think about a lot. What were you going to say?
Oh, I said it takes time, but it takes more than just time.
Yeah.
It takes effort and work.
Okay, so talking about that time and the topic we're discussing, can someone be in treatment and be in a place to where they should leave or they should transition out, but they stay? Say the family wants them to stay. They want to stay. How do you think a treatment facility should approach that situation?
Yeah. You know, and if that is indeed the case and the person really is ready and they're just fearing to put in the extra effort to get the person out of there, but do it in such a way that it's not abrupt and sudden, but to really encourage the person for that next step of growth. And it, you know, because what are you going to do? You're going to let them stay there for 6 months or a year. And then what happens is you have this place and you get new clients in and you say, oh, well, this is Bob over here. Well, how long have you been here, Bob? 11 months. And they're like, whoa. What's up with Bob? You know, everybody else is all three. You know, oh, well, Bob's a special snowflake. He comes from oil money. No, I mean, whatever. I mean, not. I mean, so, I mean, see what I mean? So you end up, you got to be careful because you end up screwing up your milieu, you know? If that runs deep, right?
When I moved into a halfway house after I got out, I moved in. I had nowhere to go. So I had very few options. And this halfway house was the only thing I could afford. So it was like $100 a week.
Yeah.
And so I could manage that because I had a little job wiping windows at a car wash.
Oh, wow.
I think I was making a strong $8.25 an hour. I was excited about that quarter raise too, by the way.
That's a lot.
And it's a lot when you've only got a little.
You got it.
I'm telling you, I still remember the first time I got a four-digit paycheck. And I even took a picture and sent it to my other convict friend. I was like, check it out. Four digits.
We
were both stoked on that. I'll never forget those times. Those times are important. But back to what I was saying, my roommate was in his 60s in this halfway house. I walk in and there's this guy. I'm like, okay, he's got twice the years I have on this planet on me. And we get to talking, nice guy. Look around his side of the room like, he's been here a minute. And I was like, so what's up, man? And it's like, what's your plan? You know, because mine was be here as little as possible. I said, how long you been here? 6 months, year and a half. And I just kind of stared at him. I said, what? And he was like, year and a half. I said, why? He said, oh, man, I'm just not ready. And I said, you ever think you're going to be? And he just kind of stared at me. I was like, sorry for bringing it. Because, and that was a big part of it. When I met that guy, heard him, and got a feel for where he was at, I decided that I called my dad. I said, Dad, I'm just telling you right now, I'm not going to be that guy. Yeah. And I'm going to get out of here. I'm making up my mind. I let him know. I was like, I'm just speaking this into existence. I will figure it out. I said, I'm going to save money. I'm figuring this thing out.
Speaking this.
And I did. I got out of there, man.
Yeah, man. But boy, that's a scared straight type of thing. Like, whoa, what, you know, I don't want to be like this guy here. No, man, that's good. And you use that as energy for your own recovery and your own personal movement. And so, but sadly, some people don't have the fight in them. And so they get complacent. Somebody else has to step in there and help them fight that fight, you know, and that's where people like you and I come in handy. We'll actually kind of, we'll do that, you know, because you pay a price when you linger the other way. That's a deeper price than taking those other risks with somebody, with some help, with some accountability, with some wisdom and discernment, you know, alongside the person. So that's a good point, man. Seeing that guy like, oh, yikes.
Well, I understand why he was hesitant too.
For sure.
Because when I moved out, with little money, you're living in a rough area, whether you like it or not. And I was no exception. And my downstairs neighbor was selling the drug I sold when I got in trouble, and they were using the drug I had just accepted.
Yeah.
Living by myself. Dude, it was tough.
And with regard to that guy, let me say this. That first safe place that you find, a lot of people find a safe place in treatment, and they just want to stay there because it's safe. And I totally get that. I respect that, right? Because this is the first time in my life I ever felt safe, or I had relationships, or people kind of cared for me. And I actually have food, and I have people in my life and meetings, and okay, I have a roof over my head. Like I've never had, you know what I mean? Some guys that have never had that, or ladies, that's
understandable. And if that's the difference between you and being on the street, and hitting the rock,
yep,
or sticking a needle in your vein, then by all means do it.
Yeah, stay. Yeah.
But it doesn't have to stop there.
No, you know, it doesn't have to.
I just want anybody for doing better.
Yeah, you know, my favorite. Never. And my lady had federal prison. She'd get out of the program, go to the Avenue J halfway house in Fort Worth, get a brick, and throw it through a post office window and go back for five more and sit there and wait for the feds to come get her because she broke into a post office at 3 a.m. All my friends are in prison. I had 5 OB-GYNs in prison. I love the food. I miss the people. That judge was so damn mad. It's funny. I love to tell that story because that's just so institutionalized, you know.
3 hots and a cot. Give me a place to stay.
Not only that, but yeah, she had a whole, and I agree with, I mean, I don't agree with her, but she did have all her friends there. She had good medical care there. She had good food. I mean, she's armed guards, perimeter patrol. I mean, real deal didn't matter, you know, didn't matter to her, you know, it's all her friends. So anyway, I mean, I just love the contrast, you know, between where we're at and where others are at. So,
yeah. The subjective normal.
Yeah, man. Did you come up with that or did you read that?
No, I mean, I just said that, but I understand.
Have you been reading from the CDC, the new normal? What?
No. I just said that just now.
Okay.
Because I'm thinking about, I'm always explaining to people that normal is whatever you understand it to be. Tijuana normal and Highland Park normal, not quite synonymous.
about 1974 AA. Normal between sin. All right. Thank you. But we got 3 minutes. 3 minutes left as we start to unravel, or I do. But I think this is a good discussion. Hopefully next week we'll be able to kind of expand on it, get some other people's perspectives on it. Kind of good for us to kind of kick that topic around of when the person has overstayed either their welcome or their treatment stay. It's an interesting concept. And it's fun to think about and fun to reflect on and something to be mindful of should you be in a capacity. And that can happen in a private practice. That can happen as a recovery coach. That can even happen as a sponsor, right?
Yeah, with sponsorship, they need to be doing something. If they're not progressing through the steps, you should probably cut them loose. Or you should. For real. You got to do something. If you're not working steps, then I'm not really sponsoring you.
There you go.
I'm co-signing your BS.
There you go. You don't want to enable. Well, folks, that's a wrap for today's show. Thanks for listening and looking, viewing the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. Neil, where can people find us and you on social media?
They can find our show at Concierge_coaches on Instagram and the Concierge Coaches Show on Facebook. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at LDLAcademy.com. How about you, Bruce?
You can find on ConciergeCoach.net. And for those of you go to the site, you may see a couple of UFC pictures with myself and Dana White and some fighters. So I might, in the weeks to come, I'm going to explain some things that happen with my relationship with UFC in a good way. And we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks. So.
It's exciting.
It is, man. All right, everybody. Take care. We'll see you here next time on the Concierge Coaches Show on LA Talk Radio. See you then.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Neil Williams, only on LA Talk Radio.